Okay, guys, the internet has requested and the gods have complied. I have with me Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Before I say hello to him, let me tell you a very small part of his CV. He's the Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at New York University, the best-selling author of many books. Let me list some of the more popular ones and some of the less popular ones: Dynamic Hedging, Fooled by Randomness, The Black Swan, The Bed of Procrustes. I had to learn how to pronounce that word. Anti-Fragile, his most latest skin in the game, and one that's forthcoming: The Logic and Statistics of Fat Tails. His official title also is he is the Greco-Phoenician Grand Emperor of Bullshit Slayers. And as to demonstrate my allegiance to him, I will now do an Arabic, or not Arabic, non-Arabic, non-Arabic cry: Bilroh, Bildem, Nifdik, Ya Nasim. How are
Okay,
you?
very, very good. Now you definitely proved that you are Phoenician god. So I have two points. The first one is effectively you missed, because you had a lot of titles, you missed the central one.
Okay.
I was a trader for 24 years.
True.
Okay, so and traders know the behavior of traders. I'm compared to other traders, I'm not even as outrageous as
Well,
they'd like.
being a trader gives you the street creds, right? So you're not just sort of some Ivy League
Yeah, I know,
guy.
but in other words, the traders have a very, very low threshold.
Right.
You see, when you see BS, they go. And the second one is all my books. To simplify, I made them one called Inserto, so you don't
Yes.
have to worry about saying all these books. One book, Inserto. Okay, yeah.
As we're starting, since our conversation is likely to take a stochastic, non-linear trajectory, I'd like to start off with a little Jewish prayer, if I may, to protect me from the stochasticity of our conversation.
Go ahead.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kiddushanu bemitzvotav lehaniach. There we go. Now I'm protected. Go.
Very good. Okay, but let me tell you also, it's beautiful to hear someone with a real accent, the Mizrahi accent.
Shukran, Habibi.
Yeah, so thank you.
I'd like to start just on a personal note, because many people may not know this, and I don't know how much you actually know the story. My history with your family goes back to well before you and I met and got to know each other. It was in 1990 when I first began at Cornell University. I had a fellow MBA student when I was doing my MBA at McGill tell me that, hey, you're going to Cornell, you should look up this fellow Lebanese. The whole Lebanese mafia was working. His name is Karim Talib. And he's a great guy. You guys will get along wonderfully. And so I reached out to him, and I remember he came over to my house. We had just met to talk to you about the hospitality of the Lebanese. We had just met. Basically, I'm useless when it comes to putting things together. I have zero ability to put furniture together. He came over and assembled my desk, which I then worked on during my PhD. So Karim Talib, if you're
Let me
listening.
ask you now that okay, do I get some credit for it in
Of
case
course.
you never pay him back? Can you pay me back instead?
Absolutely. You get all the credit. And actually, we used to, before I got a chance to meet you and chat with you and so on, but then I had learned of you, he would tell me fun stories about you and so on. And so I knew of you well before I got to meet you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm honored that your godness knew about me.
Habibi, let's start with your latest book. For those, it just came out very recently, so many people may have not had a chance to read it yet.
Actually, yesterday, this is skin in the game, and I was in a process of reading it this morning.
But did you find any typos?
I did actually, but I will tell you which ones.
Very good.
If the author can find them, yeah.
Tell us the big gist of the book.
Okay, the whole idea is, as you know, I mean, you're an economist or in some way, there's that notion that economics is about incentives. Okay, some people realize, but there's not much in literature, that economics is about disincentive. And the disincentive aspect predates, of course, anything we've done. It's the first rule ever, Hammurabi's law. Thou shalt, if an architect builds a house, the house collapses, and whatever, the architect is accountable. It means that you cannot stack someone with risk and run away from it. Okay? And I call that in trading the Bob Rubin trade. You stash Citibank with all these tail risk, and then walk away with a $100 million bonus and compensation. And then later on, when Citibank collapses, you say it was a black swan, you know, after a very, very stubborn author. So that's number two understanding of skin in the game. I went one step beyond. And now there's a third aspect to skin in the game, to that idea of symmetry between, you know, people that you as an evolutionary theorist will, I'm sure, like. And of course, you will find something that will help me prove it. And it's as follows. If you drive on a highway, even in Lebanon, okay, you can run into a person who can kill 30 people. You have enough wackos in life. Why doesn't it happen that often? People, crazy drivers. Well, simply because these people are dead.
Right.
Okay, or whatever. They've had an accident. They're paralyzed. Or they're lost the right to drive. So what happened is that those who inflict risk on others, who also inflict the same risk on themselves, tend to leave the gene pool.
Right.
And that's the central idea, is that contact with reality is a Ford via survival. So there is an equilibrium. Okay, so warmongers, historically, were warriors themselves. And as a matter of fact, they were more courageous. They took more risk than the regular person.
Yeah, they're not drone drivers 5,000 miles away from where they're going to drop the bomb.
Exactly. Or they're not working for a policy office here, advocating for war, invasion of Iraq, another invasion of this, while sitting in an air-conditioned office and not paying the price. They paid the price. So you had an equilibrium. These people filtered out because, of course, qui vit de la guerre meurt de la guerre. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. So that's the third aspect. Now, that third aspect, you can take it deeper into a lot of directions. And the most important one is, let's take academia. Okay. A plumber is judged by other plumbers. Okay. A plumber is not judged by other plumbers. He's judged by his clients. A bus driver is judged by, of course, his accident record and by reality, by the customers. A gynecologist is judged by the insurance company and the clients. Okay. There's a check. But there are fields, okay, where academics or people, professionals, are the one judging the professional without any contact with reality. Now, it so happens that academia is unfortunately subjected to this problem. Now, of course, there's some segments of academia where you have science, you have results, you have like mathematics, it's very rigorous. You can't really divert too much and create nonsense. But if 20 of us got together, created a field, created a journal, and called it the A Journal of that profession, and got into a citation ring. Okay, we can say the craziest stuff,
and it'll still be successful within that echo chamber.
Exactly, it will work very well, and we'll go to your university and ask for someone to start a department. We'll get funding, and your state, I'm sure Trudeau will give us funding, and then we'll start something about gender physics, for example, whatever you want. Okay, so this is the problem of some fields. So the skin in the game is about the symmetry in all its aspects, whether empirical, moral. You see, moral. In fact, that sure. if I want to treat you the way you treat me, or something like that, I don't want to mistreat you if I don't want to be mistreated by someone, you know, who can have power over me and stuff like that.
When you were talking earlier about sort of the academic echo chamber, I could offer a personal example to that, because when I was first setting out to demonstrate how we could, Darwinize the business school in general and consumer behavior in particular. I received a lot more blowback or obstacles, if you'd like, from academics as compared to practitioners. The practitioners would listen to my stuff and say, yeah, sure, that makes perfect sense. If you want to understand how to develop an effective advertising message, you need to tap into evolved human nature. It is the academics who were wedded to their own paradigms, who felt that if biology boy came on his horse, then they would be out of a job. So they were the ones who were a lot more vociferous in attacking my ideas than the practitioners. So it exactly speaks to your point, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is you're in an unfortunate position because you're judged by administrators, not by your clients.
Right.
And whatever your client is, clients are effectively those who read your papers and implement them in practice. Everything else is intermediary. So That is unfortunate, but of course, I'm glad. Plus, I'm very proud of you as a co-Phoenician, from someone from my from the tribes, that you managed to be absolutely no nonsense in a world where no nonsense is considered a vice, you say.
Habibi, one of the
And
biggest
courage also, the courage to stand. This is skin in the game. So skin in the game, really, when I was reading it this morning to see if the message really is coming through, and it's coming through. Skin in the game is about honor, courage, and sacrifice. If you
Exactly
don't
right.
take risks for what you do, you're nothing. That's skin in the game.
And which, by the way, speaks to, and I want to get back to how we discuss skin in the game in the context of academia, but one of the ways that I would easily link it to some of the evolutionary ideas that I cover in my own work is that for a signal to be diagnostic, it needs to be costly, and hence Zachovian signaling. And so that's exactly what you're saying, because I heard you at one point,
Exactly, exactly.
right?
Bingo. Bingo, you got it. Because I have a chapter called The Merchandising of Virtue, where I say the only virtue,
It's courage.
that cannot be
Faked
faked
is
is courage.
courage.
Okay,
Exactly.
because all the other virtues are fake. You see, that the Zachovian virtue, it is incredible. We should probably sit down and write a draft together or something.
Yalla, yalla, jay.
All right.
I actually give an example. I think you'll appreciate this. I know that you have copies of my book, but I don't know how closely you've read them, if at all. In at least one of my books, if not several of them, I talk about the end goal rich. The end goal, N apostrophe GOL. It's on the island of Vanuatu, where these guys are called land divers. So they go up on a platform that's 80 to 100 feet high. You tie vine ropes to their feet, and to demonstrate that they are courageous, they have to then jump off head first, straight down where their heads are about to splatter on the. And just a few inches before it splatters, it stops them. Well, you can't fake that courage, right? If all it took to demonstrate that I'm a warrior is for me to do 10 push-ups, then the ladies would never know who's the real warrior versus the fake. But the fact that it is so over the top heroic is what makes it honest signal.
Exactly. I mean, I actually, it's it, in social life or in my own life, I've decided to use one metric. If a person is famous, okay, or a person has an audience and is not going against some kind of power, that person is a BS vendor.
Right.
Very simple. So, in other words, if you're not fighting someone more powerful than you, okay,
Right.
and you'd be taking that, I see no evidence of courage. So saying, saying something that is expected from you is there's zero exhibition of courage.
So is that what draws the ire from you toward some of the common the some of the people that we both know? Who would be
No,
considered friends of
these
mine, but
are
whom you would hate? Is that the
no.
reason?
Yeah, but they're not the all BS vendors are the target of my ire. You may have some kind of association with people who are not like you,
Right.
basically. These people, but they're not, and they will go by packs. You don't go by packs. You go against, they go by packs. They have followers. But the idea is as follows: anything you do that doesn't entail risk taking is not an action.
Right.
And so, and to continue with the thing, so I started thinking about it, and it hit me that I felt better about myself when I'm under subjected to a smear attack.
In a sense, it's a form of anti-fragility, right? You have to
Exactly.
face the stressors to grow.
No, and not just that, and also because it means I'm bothering someone, I'm doing something, okay? I'm taking risks for whatever cause I'm following, and I feel better about myself, and I don't feel good about myself when I'm subjected to a reverse of a smear attack. Everybody's saying good things. That didn't feel good about myself when I wrote The Black Swan. Initially, okay, some people hated it, but after the crisis, I was like someone who walked on water. I hated it. You
Right.
see, I feel better. Not that I mean, I like, of course, to get recognition, but there's something about that persona standing and getting applause, and not taking any risk. So, of course, I took more risk even after with the Black Swan by some other friends of yours or some other people by attacking them. But to go back to that core thing and in human nature, that Zahavism, I tried even to apply it to religion.
Right.
And something very, very strange. I kept wondering, why is it that the Christian religion kept insisting on having the Christ man and God? And that's a theology that nobody could accept. Okay. So I thought about it. I said, well, there's something about Greek gods. Greek gods always have scars. Okay. Oh, Greek gods always got in trouble. A pure god, the way it, okay, doesn't get harmed. It's sort of like you walk on a tightrope, but there's, you know, protection in case you can't be harmed. So they wanted the Christ to suffer, okay, to have skin in the game.
But by suffering, it's a costly signal to his moral piety. It's interesting.
Exactly. And skin in the game. And then the other thing, it keeps coming back, but let me give you another dimension.
Sure.
And I saw it, and this idea came to me twice, but the most vividly when I was looking at Trump debating his the other 13 empty suits. And to me, they looked like empty suits. Okay. And Trump, whatever it was, he looked like someone alive, right? It was not empty. Whatever was there, you hate it or love it, but, right. But whatever it was, okay. So I kept thinking, what was the problem? Okay. And effectively, it was that Trump had been attacked. Someone showed the guy lost $1 billion of his own money. So you look at someone, you say, he has scars. Yeah. There's something honorable about losing. Maybe it's not true. Maybe Trump was faking it. That's not the point. The point is that having lost $1 billion of your own money made you real as compared to pencil pushers. And that the American public definitely detected in the election. It's the same costly signaling. You know what? At least I'm human. I take risk. Okay. Costly signal. I'm still here. I lost $1 billion. So it's sort of like those scars that Roman soldiers would exhibit by showing, hey, I was in battle. How about you?
So not only is costly signaling relevant in explaining the attraction that people felt toward Trump, but if you and I as academics demonstrate any positive response to Trump, that itself is a costly signal.
Of course. It means, hey, come get me. All right. So, and also it means that I don't have to worry about your fitting your criteria. So, and actually you and I, as people who write, let's say not just academics, every negative review, you see, every attack on us augments that.
Right.
Because, and let me give you a very simple anecdotal thing. I just got an email saying that my book is number 7 in London, okay, on their bestseller. And the bestseller list has books like, you know, for that you would probably stop reading after age 4 and a half, that kind of stuff. And then my book is very hard to read for them, that category. That's the Sunday Times section. A biography of athletes usually is what makes it. So, and actresses. So the, and I was wondering what was happening, you know, all my reviews in London were horrible, were attacks, okay? But there were attacks, okay? So it's just the dimension of anti-fragility that you seem to bring with your costly signaling, right?
Beautiful.
That book is still sold in spite of the attacks, all right? It means it can sustain.
Right. Now, and so one of the chapters in your book, or one of the, not passages, but I guess chapters, you in the latest book, you talk about the minority rule, which you had mentioned that you'd love for us to talk about today. And then I pulled out, because as I was reading that passages in your book, those passages, it reminded me of something that I wrote as part of a Canadian Senate testimony, which I'd like to read first.
Yeah,
And then, because it's going to so beautifully fit with what you wrote. So this is, for those of you who don't know, I testified in front of the Canadian Senate regarding Bill C-16, the gender identity and gender expression issue. And at one point, I say the following: ongoing governmental efforts are pushing for a gender-neutral society to cater to an extraordinarily small number of non-binary or non-gendered people who feel marginalized at having to provide their biological sex as part of their profiles. This is the tyranny of the minority. 99% of the population should acquiesce to having a default feature of their personhood erased because a few individuals might be inconvenienced by it. That's exactly your minority rule, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. When you have a symmetry, and it works, still it doesn't work anymore. And do you want me to give the background? You'd like
Yeah,
to.
go ahead. Some people might not know what it is. Yeah.
Okay, so and the beauty of this is that it can take us into evolutionary territory and into collective versus individual. I was setting up the barbecue at the Complex System Institute. Okay, and we're inviting people to talk to them about complex system. And I learned one thing, ironically, at that barbecue. A bunch of people from Jerusalem came, all right, to the barbecue to talk about complexity. And they were very, very religious. You can see very religious. And I was helping with the stand, the lemonade, the food. And I felt, oh boy, because I was among the people who were helping. I said, oh boy. We made a mistake. We don't have kosher food for these people. So I was wondering how to get out of that difficult situation till one of them, a religious Jew, said, oh, don't worry about it. It's all kosher. The lemonade, don't worry. The drinks, oh, they're going to be kosher. What? Yeah, they're kosher. What do you mean they're kosher? I bought them. No, they're kosher. So we looked at it. At the bottom, it was written kosher. So effectively, 0.3% of the population of the United States is kosher, and close to 100% of soft drinks are, including Coca-Cola. Why? Because it's very simple. You're Coca-Cola, right, and you're making a drink. You make it kosher. You got to make it kosher, not kosher, merchandising, this different truck, this different shelves. No, what do? You make them all kosher, because I can drink kosher. All right, but the kosher person cannot drink non-kosher.
And hence, that's the asymmetry.
Exactly, very simple asymmetry. and that asymmetry, you start looking at its effects of the asymmetry. For kosher drinks, it's obvious. The cost is small. Sometimes if the cost becomes large, then you don't have that asymmetry. Okay, and you look at the effect of the asymmetry in consumer decision. Is someone coming from Mars, looking at the behavior of Americans, he would say, well, people are religious, glad kosher in this country, right? From Mars, because they don't know the detail. So there are a lot of things we can infer from it. The first one is that a minority can impose its will on you, okay, if they're intolerant. And the second one is that, and that's harder to discuss now, it's explain at length in the book, it takes a while to get it, that much of ethics comes from the fact that we have laws, it becomes from a few very, very ethical people.
Right, so that goes against the folk intuition that there would have had to be consensus, there would have had to be a majority agreement.
Exactly, because this I got it from studying halal, all right? Mm-hmm. And I noticed that, okay, if a person eats halal, he will not eat non-halal, but the reverse. And then I noticed that, and you know very well, the Semitic languages, or that Semitic language called Arabic today, that halal means legal.
Right. Halal or haram.
Of course, it means illegal. So I looked at it. I said, well, it's not just food to which this applies. It's also what is permissible, what's not. You see, like theft, mail haram, you see, you can't touch it, okay? Stolen merchandise, you can't touch it, you see? So you understand. So it took me, I started doing experiments, playing with a computer and taking long walks, which is beats a computer, and then thinking about it that as follows, right? Let us say that we have two methods of poisoning a crowd, okay? One method is you put a drop in a drink, either it kills you, all right, the smallest drop kills you. That's a minority rule. In other words, I have this coffee here. If I put cyanide in my coffee, all right, it would be coffee with cyanide. No matter how much coffee I add to it, it will still be, it's a minority rule, same effect, okay, up to a point, of course. So, and then the other method is you give something that has 50% chance of killing you. Okay, it's stochastic or property, whatever, consensus properties. And then conditional on that, then you're told that half the people died. You know it's not the minority rule. They're not a cyanide. And if you're told that everybody died or everybody's alive, it's a minority rule.
مظبوط.
مظبوط.
When I was reading that particular chapter, I was thinking, wait a minute, this is exact what he's talking about is exactly the mechanism I have used to explain the dangers of the slow Islamization of the West. And then lo and behold, as I read further, that's exactly what you talked about. But before I cede the floor to you, in one of my public conversations with your very, very good buddy, very good friend, Sam Harris, be nice, kun latif, kun latif. I was on his show and I was explaining to him that the key danger when we're discussing immigration doesn't come from the fact that we have to stop a few radical ISIS people. Of course we have to do that. But the much greater danger when you take a longer temporal view of the issue is that once you slowly Islamize a particular ecosystem, then it's only a matter of time with a very few number of people to then, and then I don't know if in his case I had used the example of Coptics, in Egypt, yeah. But there are many cases where a country was not Islamized through the sword, it was shwaye shwaye, bit by bit, and that's exactly what you talk about. So maybe you could expand on that.
Okay, so what happened for the minority rule to work, you need to have an open system, not mountainous areas. So and you need to have, say, distributed in the whole country, it's not local, you see, you need to have that kind of thing. It so happened that in the Levant, where we're from, the Levant is mountainous and people don't mix. But in Egypt, that's open, it so happened that people intermarried a little bit. And there is a very simple Islamic rule. Once you're in, you can't get out. And if any of the parents is Muslim, the children are Muslim, all right? So it simplifies. So what happens, that very slow rate of, very, very slow rate of conversion moves the population from 5% to 95%,
right?
Maybe 97 now. I mean, they lie about the statistics, but something. So, and all it takes is just a little bit of conversion, not much, a small rate of conversion, because it's not stochastic. It's stochastic maybe, but it's not reversible, you see? So it goes, it's like an absorbing barrier mathematically. So when you look at, you back out from the Markov chain, what you get, you realize you need very small probability, very small rate of conversion will give you after 1,300 years, okay, a majority. For example, that's one. Effectively, Egypt had other things going for it, which is that, and then in my definition of religion, let me start by saying one thing. When you say Islam, I don't hear Islam. But to me, that's not Islam, because I know Shiite Islam is a complete different religion, much more tolerant and not a problem, and it doesn't have these same minority rules. And it's Wahhabi Islam. And effectively, what has happened to Islam over the past 50 years is an Islamization of Islam itself, or Wahhabization. And I remember, okay, you were in Lebanon as a kid. I was in Lebanon as a kid. The way I recognize a Muslim woman from a Christian one is Christian women, particularly like old babushka, old Russian grandmother, the Orthodox, would dress conservatively with a headband. And Muslim women didn't have any,
right,
because
right.
That was not part of the religion. It was some kind of, okay, so that's the first statement, I'd say. The second one is that you have to interpret Islam not as a religion, but as a legal system. And so I have my chapter on the legal system. It's what we say religion is not religion. Christianity is not a legal system, because when it came, it was built at the time when the Romans had monopoly of law. So the Christianity never really managed to be legal, even when it was a theocracy at some point, and it was never part of the legal system. They had separate courts, whatever it was. Whereas Islam is legal. It's not a religion. It's a legal system. And Judaism was initially a legal system and then became both tribal, Islam the same, but universal. Okay, and you can understand that from, we know from languages, deen in Hebrew means law. Deen in Arabic means religion, which
right.
means that it's not religion, right? So, and in Aramaic, you don't say deen for religion, you say nomos, which is law, for law, nomos, the Greek word for nomos. So you have to realize what happened with, over time, is that the Turks really took Islam without really taking much of the law.
Right.
They had their own, they heard kanun and worked with it. So it was a different religion. It's a complete different religion that was Wahhabized by the Saudis, over the past 50 years and made them tolerant. And the minority rule works right there. If I put a Wahhabi, you put a Wahhabi with 30 non-Wahhabi people.
It's only a matter of time, yeah.
The 31 will behave like a Wahhabi. You see, that is the problem. So there are some tricks. And actually what we have to do the work is not here. It's just weakening Saudi Arabia's aims to change their own the people within their own religion. That's it.
And I would say when you drew, I love your analysis of the topography of Egypt versus Lebanon, in that because of the unique topography of Lebanon, it doesn't allow the minority rule to take as much of an effect. Now, I will draw an analogy between the topography, and I will argue that the ideological topography in the West of being so open, being so tolerant, in a sense, that creates the flat ground. You don't have mountains of ideological defenses against that which should not be tolerated. So in a sense, we are the Egypt of that dynamic when it comes to the ideological topography. Do you agree?
I more than agree on one point. The EU, that's my problem with the EU. I was trying to explain why in complex system you need pockets. You see, so America is not a country, it's not a republic. America is a federation, where basically the states can do whatever they want. Okay, it's a collection of states that blocks minority rule. Right. If you universalize, so what happened in Europe when you have pockets, small states, city states, each one will have its own rules. The minority rule will not spread.
Right.
But when this thing come from the top, and now the EU is imposing ideas from the, you see, that's a problem. It's opening up the system too much. Which is, and now you should probably explain it to proponents of Brexit.
I was going to say, you should talk to your boyfriend, Richard Dawkins, about Brexit.
Yeah, my friend. Yeah, he's anti-Brexit, I assume. Yeah, all of the right things. I don't know how you have friends with these people, but anyway. Let's keep this to a private conversation, all right?
Yeah, that's good. Okay, let's move on. I wanted to spend, before we move on to minority rule. So clearly the dynamics of the minority rule as applied to, say, the spread of Islam in the West could just as easily be applied to social justice warrior dynamics on campuses. You have a very, very small minority who are very vocal. And so the optics is that everybody is a rabid social justice warrior on campus, which of course is not the case. Most just want to go about studying their biology and psychology and business. But the few very small can completely grab the narrative, correct? Is that same idea?
Yeah, I'll go even beyond by saying the following. Pretty much everything you see on campus is determined by a small number of individuals, okay, who are costing your parents or the parents thousands of dollars of hard-earned money to just have a diversity officer and all of that thing. People just want to study something technical. It's going to kill universities, but there's one interesting thing with the minority rule, and I'll use the Christians as part of that. You know, halal is neutral, okay, today, because you don't know about it. But as people detect the minority rule, they start rebelling.
Right.
And there is an actually Arab poet that you'll never read in any Arab country or so-called members of Arab League country. But we know because he was Christian. And he said, I will not eat sacrificial lamb. Mm. Okay. I will not eat meat that is okay. And then he'll say, what? It turned out that they refuse the halal as identity because the Christians actually were force-fed sacrifice of meat during the Roman Empire as punishment for Christian, and some of them would die of starvation. Okay, they say, I'll die of starvation and would not open my lips.
How is that for a costly signal?
That's exactly. So some people have rebelled against minority rule. Minority rule is only works when it's sneaky. As I said, it was irreversible rate of conversion. But the minority rule, if it's too visible, and if you make it visible to people, they automatically rebel.
Well, incidentally, there's a concept in originally in psychophysics, which then has been applied in marketing. This is the idea of the differential threshold or the just noticeable difference. So for example, if I'm a company that's selling candy bar and it costs $1 for 100 grams for the candy bar, I'd like to increase the price. But if I increase the price, that's too salient. So I'd like to then decrease the weight of the candy bar. So if it's at 100 grams, I'd like to find out how much can I reduce it so that most people don't notice the difference, right? So if it's at 100 grams, maybe if I reduce it to 95, nobody can pick up that five gram difference. But if I reduce it by 10 grams, everybody will pick it up. So that concept of just noticeable difference is used in marketing when you either want people to notice a change or if you don't want them to notice a change. And that's exactly what you're saying, because in the case of Islam, well, if we concede this little thing, what's the big deal? So it falls below the just noticeable difference. And then one day you wake up, it's the old parable about the boiling frog, right? One day you wake up, boom, we're 95% Islamic, correct?
No, I'm first of all, Islam, there are a lot of Islams. It's Wahhabi Islam that is
fair enough
intolerant. Okay, so this is what I'm saying about the religion. So we have to separate into, unlike your friends, you know, we have to be a little more fine-tuned about what religion, whether people have this religion or that religion. There's Sufi Islam, there's branches of Sunni Islam in Central Asian Islam. So they have a lot of religion. But I would say one thing, that the Shiite Islam, for example, doesn't have these properties.
Right.
They follow the majority. They don't have minority rules.
Right.
Okay. So the minority rule, once visible, irritates people beyond measure.
Right. Which, I mean, to put it in the terms that I said earlier, once it is above the just noticeable difference, the game is up.
Exactly. So, but the minority rule, you have to also be aware, plays on both sides.
Right.
And often you confuse. But one more additional thing is, since you're in consumer marketing, if you watch, let's look at minority rule in this context. Most cars that you buy in America are automatic shift, not stick shift.
Right.
Why is it so? Because at a time when they introduced these things, a family of four, one person doesn't drive stick shift. They have one car.
Right.
Okay. They're going to buy automatic. And this is how the thing spread.
Very interesting. Two more things we could talk about, but we want to keep the people coming, so we'll have many more of these conversations. First, this is in your past book, Anti-Fragile. As I was, again, when I try to read your stuff, I right away try to think of links to evolutionary theories, since that's my area. And I was trying to think of whether there is some sort of taxonomy that allows us to predict which types of phenomena would benefit from anti-fragile properties versus those that wouldn't. And then so I thought, of course, one of the things that I study most is mating behavior. And so I thought, okay, well, we know that in human mating, we have what's called assortative mating, meaning that birds of a feather flock together. We know that if we try to predict the likelihood of success of a long-term union, people who are more similar to one another are more likely to stay together rather than if they complement, if they're opposite from each other. But from an anti-fragile perspective, you would argue that the chaos of being different from each other would be a good thing. So does anti-fragility work at all in the context of human?
I've explained it. I've explained what I mean by anti-fragility in the same context, but let me give you a different one.
Right.
You need variation, but not too much, not too little.
Mm.
So let's talk about parthenogenesis, which is even step zero of evolution, you know? Okay, so you have one organism, and okay, how do you have evolution? That organism produces copies of itself with some random error. The random error, you're convex to error. In other words, those with the positive error make it, those with a negative error don't make it. So you're just gonna have some mutation towards, you know, fitness in an environment, okay? Now, let's say that the error rate is too low, you don't change. Okay? If the error rate is too high, what happens? You change too much, you don't retain the advantage of the previous. Okay?
Right.
So this is exactly the point about variation. You need to have a variance that is not too high and not too little.
So in the specific context of whether people who are more alike tend to have more successful unions or not, are you saying that if they were too similar or too dissimilar, that would be incorrect, but somewhere there's a happy medium in between.
Exactly. And let me go one by one. If it's too similar, it's sort of like having, producing, it becomes incest.
it's a clone of yourself.
Okay, sorry, clone. All right, so it becomes pure, so doesn't work. Okay, incest with a twin, So with a pure, equivalent. If you are, but now if you have too much variation, too much variety, then what happens is that you may have some payoff from that variety because you have offspring that, of course, will be stochastically dependent on either parents. So you have a lot of spreading. And then what happens is that the ones that are fit, you see, you have a variance that allows you to find the fitness of the one. Now, the problem with next generation, you see, you may not be in that bandwidth to. I don't know what terms you use for that. So it's exactly the same, as I mentioned earlier, with that error rate in dimension two.
Right.
See, okay, so is it simple? Here we have two dimensions, the same problem. One is dimension zero or dimension one, to say. So what happens is if you have too much mutation or if you have too much variance, it doesn't work. So you need to be in the middle, have enough variance, but not too much.
And hence the grandmother's axiom of everything in life in moderation, correct?
Exactly. Not too much, not too little. But enough variation. But then let's generalize from that. People are for progress, okay? Everybody should be for progress because nature is for progress, all right? So but at what rate you want to change? If you change too fast, you don't retain the benefits of what you've changed.
Right.
So there is in everything there is a sweet side. The way I explain it best also in Anti-Fragile is as follows. Shocks and variability are good for you, all right? So if I jump 1 meter, okay, my bones are going to get stronger. If I jump 0 meters, my bone density will drop.
Right.
If I jump 10 meters, what happens?
They break.
I'll die, right? Yeah. So therefore, the sweet spot is between 0 and 2 meters, maybe, whatever it is.
By the way, it applies to, say, personality traits. Take, for example, perfectionism. If you're not sufficiently perfectionist, then your work might suffer. You're not conscientious. You're not detail-oriented. If you're too perfectionist, as I tend to suffer from that, then you become frozen in rechecking your work. Darwin forbid, I may have a comma that's wrong somewhere, so I'll spend 5 hours rechecking my email to make sure that there's no error. So there is some sweet spot between the perfectionism and too much perfectionism that is the right point. So it's the exact same idea.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. So Anti-Fragile for a system is benefiting from being convex, but you're never infinitely convex. You're convex within an S-curve, typically.
Right. Right,
see, beautiful. You're compact with an S-curve. So there's an S-curve. Effectively, it's actually not just an S-curve. Now we know it's an S-curve. We'll go back now.
Right.
Last
point, and then we'll pick it up, hopefully, in many future chats. And I love this, that you cover rationality from an evolutionary perspective, because I want to sort of set the ground for what we're going to talk about. So I came out, my doctoral training was very much within the behavioral decision theory, the Kahneman-Tversky, your friend Richard Thaler, who was my professor at Cornell. Yes. So I very much came out of the, what some have called, and myself, the violation of the month club, right? Here is yet another violation of how we're not as Homo economicus tells us we are. And I became very frustrated. I mean, to me, it was like, I get it. There is a unicorn species that only exists in the deep recesses of the economist's mind. We don't act like them. Let's move on. Let's study why the human brain has evolved to be the way that it is. And that's how I then became an evolutionist. So in your case, you exactly incorporate the correct idea of rationality, which is to root it in evolutionary theory. So it's ecological rationality as compared to normative rationality. Maybe you could talk about this.
Yes, okay. I mean, I've learned a lot from people, I'm sure you know. I saw your picture at a center where I was a visitor as well in the Max Planck Institute.
Max Planck Institute. Before, I need to interrupt you before you go on. When I was at Max Planck and I was asked to write something for that photo, in that great wall of people, the guy who asked me, of course, I met... the guy was Gerd Gigerenzer and Peter Todd. So Peter Todd asks me to go in a room so that I can write some lines, sort of immortalize my visit. And I I do something very quickly. Then he comes back to me very politely, as Peter is, and he goes, "You realize this is going to be on the wall forever, right?" So I said, "Okay, so you're basically saying that what I just wrote sucks and I need to think about it." He goes, "Yes, please." So that's the story, but go on.
Okay, so I saw your picture there, and I saw I've been a visitor of that group, and to inform our the people, viewers, what it is, it's a different behavior by looking at rationality in terms of evolutionary traits in an ecological environment, not narrowed down laboratory style. So I worked a lot with GERD, and the quantum leap I took was one day I was invited for a retreat in a German town. I forgot the name, but supposedly the one that doesn't exist. There's a conspiracy about it.
Is this the Max Planck castle?
No. Oh. There's a city called something that's supposed to be, there's a conspiracy, it doesn't exist. So because nobody goes there, and effectively there's nothing there. So I went for 4 days with Gerd Gegranzer, and there was a fellow who has really put the foundations of rationality. Okay, and his name is Ken Benmore. Probably, it's like a giant, okay, mathematician. He does game theory, and there were other people in game theory. So that was my jump. My jump is looking at how, effectively orthodox economics define rationality. They don't, it's not an accounting trick. They don't even ask for it. It just asks you to be coherent. That's it.
Right.
And even they can tolerate within the norms of rationality, okay? It is effectively irrational to confuse rationality with first-order logic, right? Because you have to put the background. It's within the foundation. And he said that it's not irrational to give your coat to a random person walking by if that's what you think your mission in life is to do.
Right.
So he reconciled all these things from narrow accounting and all these attacks on rationality. But what I took away from him is effectively the notion of revelation of preferences. Okay, that when you deal with rationality, and that was his idea, you should absolutely ignore what people are saying, because that's background furniture.
Right.
So if you say, oh, Darwin, maybe your form of theology, I use Baal, all right? But the fact is, you shouldn't observe it, you should observe what people do.
Right.
So I then came back and wrote that chapter on the Pope, where I said that the Pope is as atheist as they come, because what matters, according to these people, is not whether you believe or don't believe, is how you act in regular life. Okay? In regular life, when the Pope is shot, he doesn't really invoke the supernatural immediately. He goes first to the hospital. And then so I looked and here and I made the basis of a difference between atheism and secularism. You see? Is that, in fact, the difference between them is not... And this is one thing. This is why I don't like your friends. The what you say should never be taken literally, because it has no value. You know that from consumers. What people pay that matters. That's what you do. If you analyze preferences revealed in actions and just actions, and then look at consistency and consistency in action, you will see absolutely no difference between atheists and secularists.
Right.
So hence that distinction is just background furniture. I observe Lent. I go to church. I pray. But in my behavior, and I think that you're an atheist or something like that, whatever you call yourself, but in our behavior, when we are walking down the street, we do the same thing.
Right.
And they're basically indistinguishable. And I say, when I'm in church, the other person is at a concert. Okay. All right. And then, this is where the preference revealed. So, but it took me even one step further into religion. Is that effectively religion only exists when you have sacrifice for it.
Right.
Otherwise, you're an atheist. And you know, the gods, Baal and our gods, long before monotheism came, they didn't care. You believe in them. They wanted you to give them 30% of your land, this. That's it. The religion was sacrifice. It's just like the I love you doesn't count, all right? You need an engagement ring, costly signaling.
Exactly.
Signaling. So you go back to religion. So to me, anything that doesn't have any costly signaling is indistinguishable from atheism, from that standpoint of preferences revealed. So, you see, so therefore, what you guys call atheism, all right, and secularism from a standpoint of except for some whatever behavior is I see very little difference.
So let me ask you this, since we're talking about religion, it's tough to not go down that trajectory for a few minutes. From an evolutionary perspective, there are several theories that have been proposed to explain why religion exists. And so I'll mention two very brief ones, and then you'll tell me if either of them strike a chord with you. And I have a sense that I can predict which one you probably feel more comfortable with. So religion as an adaptation would basically argue that, look, there's an adaptive value to being religious. So that's the argument of David Sloan Wilson. Using a group selectionist argument, he basically will say, look, a religious group has greater communality, greater cohesion, greater in-group, out-group distinction. That results in that group out-surviving a group that doesn't have religiosity. Another group of evolutionists like Pascal Boyer, who was also on my show, and David Sloan Wilson is a good friend, Pascal Boyer argues, no, religion is an exaptation. It's a byproduct. It piggybacks on neural mechanisms that existed for another purpose, agency detection, tribal coalitional thinking. So these systems existed, and then they're parasitized by religion. So is your view that religion is adaptive or exaptive?
I think the first one. Because
that's what I thought you would say, okay.
From a standpoint of survival, and also from a standpoint of more like a mathematization of a process, effectively, you and I know that what will make us survive is that we've survived several hundred million years. Okay, so there's a law of large numbers involved. Is traits that are convex to errors. Okay, in other words, paranoia and stuff. And these can only be through interdicts. Okay, an interdict, okay, can only be conveyed through religion. Let me give you an example. You can, what I said is, if you're halal or if you're kosher, you can say, I'm kosher because I only eat very little, but I only eat very little pork. I don't eat a lot. You can't say that. There's no low-carb diet equivalent. Things come in block. And then the interdicts, and you don't have to explain an interdict. You just take it in block, all right? So these are two conditions, block and interdict. So therefore, that's the only way to transmit risk management interdicts and rules through generations.
But for example, in the consuming instinct, using the lens of today's understanding of, you know, pathogens, I explain how, let's say, the kosher edict of not eating shellfish, or clams or whatever, would have solved a very important biological problem, which is there is no way.
I disagreed with that.
Okay, why is that?
Okay, I said like the fact is kosher. You have 500 some dietary rules, and if you take Maimonides, they tell you okay that pork, we don't know that it's not necessarily for health. I think it's a social marker, having interdict. It's also signaling. In other words, the Jews band together because it's almost impossible for a Jew to eat with a non-Jew if you have 500 dietary laws.
So might it be the case that different rules of purity and diet serve different adaptive functions?
I think maybe, but the way I look at it is I look at the success of Jews came from two things. They band together and they have colonies. Think about it. If I'm going to go to Marseille and I eat kosher, it's impossible for me, you know, unless there's a community there. So you go from Jewish community to Jewish community. And then I think it did, given that you're both Phoenician and Judean, it did, and Judeans and Phoenicians were the same language, okay, if not the same stock. They started going to that Phoenician colonies and going. That's the first one. The second one is quite central. Think about what would have happened if Jews could mix, you see? So this is why interdicts are very good for that. And I've read a lot in the literature what happened to Islamic travelers, right?
Right.
They didn't have a colony. They couldn't go to France. So they couldn't eat halal and they couldn't travel. So hence my ancestors were merchants going to the West because they could go to the West. They didn't have a problem. And it's quite another interesting, very interesting thing that when you look at prohibition against alcohol, it's not clear in Islam. And I think they made it to prevent socialization with you guys.
Now, do you think that as they get these revelations or these edicts, that they actually know the earthly reasons.
No.
Oh, so they genuinely believe that they are divinely ordained.
People have random rules. People have random rules. And those who have the right rules survive. But the point is, again, I mean, this whole notion of ex ante rationality doesn't exist. It's ex post. It's people have some weird things that you don't quite understand, not consciously. It's too complex. That's ecological rationality. Just those who have the randomly, you know, that random property. This is why you should not never throw the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
The other thing I have is that anyone, I'm going to say it bluntly, anyone who thinks that religious beliefs are epistemic knows nothing about religion and knows nothing about science. They're not epistemic, you see. The difference is scientific statement is literal and should be there not to allow you to survive or allow you to die. It should be there for its truth value, period.
So does that sound like so Stephen Jay Gould talks about the NOMA principle. Are you familiar with that? Do you know what that is?
Yes.
The NOMA principle is non-overlapping magisteria. So he was, if you like, conciliatory. He's saying, look, that there are certain things that we get uniquely from religion, and there are other things that we get from science. We don't need to pit them against one another, and hence they are NOMA, non-overlapping magisteria.
Yeah.
So what you're saying seems to at least coincide with his position.
No, I have much more brutal difference. Okay, what we have is what I say. Science doesn't make any religious claims. Science is about what is scientific. It's the application of science. People apply science, but science doesn't tell you how to eat. Science is about epistemic statements, purely epistemic. It doesn't tell you how to eat, how to behave, what to do moral. It doesn't tell you. Okay. Decision making. All right. Okay, it's different. Decision making is risk management. So the way you layer it is that science is a statistical statement that needs to remain and be as literal and statistical and rigorous as you can. And it's very unrigorous. And if you start taking, I mean, I was very influenced by Ken Binmore when I figured out that, again, that's not what I got from him directly, but when I figured out that if you go back, reread the economics, they're not making these statements that people claim they're making. Well, it's the same thing with science.
Right.
Start looking at the science, doesn't make the claims. They're fine. They're making claims that if you do this, and it works all times. That's it. Right? They're not making claims about how you should behave, whether you should believe this or that. That's the preferences revealed. But science doesn't have preferences revealed.
So that speaks, I guess, to in decision making, you talk about the difference between normative decision making, the Homo economicus stuff, prescriptive decision making. This is operations research, the traveling salesman problem. If you want to minimize or optimize something, do X, Y, Z. And descriptive decision making, which simply describes behavior as a psychologist would. So in a sense, you seem to be following that kind of taxonomy where, you know, depending, science might fall into one and religion falls into another. One is normative, one is prescriptive, one is descriptive. Does that seem fair?
I didn't follow these because given that I'm in decision science myself, sort of what I work with, statistical decision science, and then describe it this way. And then there's a technicity that effectively destroys behavioral economics.
Right.
The technicity is that they think that if you start saying that we should understand the world without a mistake, I'm going to give you a thought experiment. Okay. You make mistakes, mistakes are not free. And that's sort of like the idea of an anti-fragile that I further discussed in the game. If you, God forbid, have an appointment tomorrow with the most important point in your life, okay, thing in your life at 9 a.m., okay, when should you get there?
A few minutes earlier.
Okay, there you go. So if you make a mistake in getting there, you'd rather be earlier than late.
Right.
So some mistakes are good, some mistakes are bad. Okay. So if a plane cannot afford to make some classes of mistakes.
Right.
Crashes. All right. So the point is, and this is what your evolutionary, not evolutionary, your behavioral finance Taylor types don't get.
Right.
That overestimating small probabilities is a necessity to survive. Just like getting 10 minutes earlier for your flight. 2 hours. We'll make us get 2 hours earlier, you know, earlier. You should be doing 10 minutes because that's what it takes, you know, an ideal thing. It takes 10 minutes. You know? So that's it. Under stochastic environments, you have to have some biases.
Right.
And these are not biases. They are necessary. So you start eliminating all the theories, doing that dynamically particularly. And then the second statement is that they think they give you a cigarette, okay, and then they tell you you smoke a cigarette, you derive this pleasure, it costs you so much in risk, okay, and it's foolish to overestimate the risk of cigarettes.
Right.
Okay, but we know that you don't smoke a cigarette once, you smoke. So they don't do one experiment. Oh, you overestimate the losses of money. Yeah, but if I don't do that, I'll go bankrupt. In a dynamic framework. So they don't understand dynamic framework. So this book, the last chapter, which to me is the most important, probably the most important thing I've written, because synthesis of everything I've written, it's called the logic of risk taking. Very simple, logic of risk taking. Yeah. No, I'm looking at the name of the chapter, the logic, it was called logic of risk bearing, of course. I was just verifying logic of risk taking. And that logic of risk taking is about this. And there's something called ergodicity.
Right.
In other words, when you put time into it. Thank you very much for.
Habibi, maybe Shaba Minnak. We were supposed to only speak for 20 minutes, but I told you that there's no way to only last 20 minutes with the godliness himself.
Thank you, your godliness, for your generosity, intellect, and remarkable erudition for us. Listen, for us and my family, I'm sure probably is vastly more important than intellect.
كتير كتير لذيذ حبيبي. لازم اجي ازورك بنيويورك لان مشتاق لك.
انت معزوم.
شكرا حبيبي. شكرا حبيبي. ضلك على الخط دقيقه.
Yeah, sorry visitors, we're speaking Phoenicians.
Cheers.